Right, so for today, we're going to read a passage from the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 26. We've already heard one or two passages from this sutta already. It's one of the major suttas on the life of the Buddha. And for this evening, we're going to look at the passage that's dealing with the Buddha's practice under his former teachers. Yes, I know. Oh, my goodness. All right. So, and the Buddha is speaking. Mendicants, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened, but intent upon awakening, I too, being liable to be reborn, sought out what is also being liable to be reborn. Myself, liable to grow old, fall sick, die, sorrow, and become corrupted, I sought what is also liable to these things. Then it occurred to me, why do I, being liable to be reborn, grow old, fall sick, sorrow, die, and become corrupted, seek things that have the same nature? Why don't I seek the unborn, unaging, unailing, undying, sorrowless, uncorrupted, supreme sanctuary, extinguishment? Sometime later, while still black-haired, and we've looked at this passage before, but sometime later, while still black-haired, blessed with youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, dressed in ochre robes, and went forth from the lay life to homelessness. Once I had gone forth, I set out to discover what is skillful, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. So this is presumably after he's already arrived in Rajagaha, and if we are to take it as chronological, after the events of the previous sutta we read last night. I approached Alara Kalama and said to him, Reverend Kalama, I wish to live the spiritual life in this teaching and training. So I'll just mention a few details as we go, because it's a slightly long story, so if I read to the end, then I might not get all the details as we go. First thing is to notice that the text doesn't really specify the place, but I imagine it's probably likely that it was in the Rajagaha region. We don't really know who Alara Kalama is, and we don't get much of a clue from this passage about what his teaching was. However, and I'll talk more about this later, I think it's, even though it's an inference, I think it's likely that he was a teacher, a Brahmanical teacher in the Upanishadic tradition. Notice that the terminology that the Buddha is using here is familiar ones that the Buddha also used to live the brahmacharya, the spiritual life, and he uses the term the Dhamma Vinaya, the teaching and training. Just as a point of translation, normally when people translate Vinaya, they translate it as discipline. And we discussed yesterday about the Pali Canon, about how we have a book called the Vinaya, which is dealing with monastic conduct. And I don't like that translation for two reasons. Number one being that that discipline per se is only a small part of the Vinaya Pitaka itself. It deals with a lot of different kinds of things, and discipline is only one of those things. But more to the point, in the suttas, when the suttas talk about Dhamma Vinaya, I believe that they only rarely mean the actual monastic code that we call the Vinaya Pitaka. So, yes, occasionally they refer to the Vinaya Pitaka, but usually when the suttas say Dhamma Vinaya, they mean it in a more general sense, where the Dhamma is more like the theory, the teaching, and the Vinaya is the application of that teaching or the training. And so Venerable Brahmali and myself had some discussions about this, and this is a good example of that, because here the Buddha is referring to Alara Kalama's teaching as the Dhamma Vinaya. Clearly, here Vinaya can't mean the Buddhist monastic code. And I don't think that this is... So previous translators, like someone like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, would tend to treat this as an exception and would tend to assume that Dhamma Vinaya usually meant the monastic code. But I think that's the mistake, and I think that usually it does not mean that, and we should assume that it does not mean, that Vinaya does not mean the monastic code unless the context makes it clear. Generally speaking, it just means the practical application of the teaching. Okay, so Alara Kalama replied, "Stay, Venerable. This teaching is such that a sensible person can soon realize their own tradition with their own insight and live having achieved it." So this is somewhat a bit difficult to capture the sense of this phrase in translation, but this idea of their own, realize their own tradition, the word here is actually the word Theravada is later. Sorry, I mistake that. Mistook that. Hang on, let me just get the Pali text. Realize their own tradition. Sorry about that. 1 second. Hello, phone, don't freeze up. Thank you. Okay. Their own tradition. So their own tradition, yes, Sakang Acharya Kang, right. This is a bit of a difficult idiom to figure out, but basically their own, the Sakang Acharya Kang means the lineage or the tradition of their teachers. So this is an important point. So that the point here is that Alara Kalama is saying to the Bodhisattva that there is this tradition, and if you come and practice in here, you can actually realize that for yourself. And that's something which is a distinctive feature of many of the Indian traditions. That they relied on that idea that you can actually experience these things for yourself. Not all traditions were like that. In fact, the Buddha was to later make a distinction between certain traditions who rely solely on logic and reasoning, certain traditions that rely only on, say, acceptance of faith in the lineage or belief in what is in the texts. So there are many different traditions, but some of the traditions in ancient India believed that you could take what was in that tradition and actually practice it and realize it for yourself. And of course, that's also the Buddha's tradition, right? So this is something that the Buddha continued on, that idea which he learnt from Alara Kalama. So then the Buddha said, "I quickly memorized that teaching, Kipameva Tang Dhammang Pariyaponing." And again, translators will often say, with something like Pariyaponing, they'll say something like, "I quickly learned that teaching." Or something like, "I studied that teaching," or something like that. And this is something which is a bit difficult to convey in translation, because the manner of education that we do today is very different from what was done in those days. So typically, the first part of the teaching, the first thing you'd do would be to memorize the texts, and you would sit down with a teacher, and the teacher would recite the text, and you would memorize it, and the teacher would also explain the meaning of it. So you were memorizing texts. So in my translation, I wanted to try to convey this kind of sense that when you're talking about learning something, you're not just, you know, listening to a Dhamma talk or reading a book or something. You're actually memorizing the texts themselves. And he goes on, "So far as lip recital and oral recitation were concerned, I spoke with knowledge and the authority of the elders. I claimed to know and see, and so did others." Okay, so here then it's reaffirming and reiterating that this is talking about the memorizing and reciting of an oral scripture. And the word, the authority of the elders, is Theravada. So these days we talk about Theravada Buddhism. Within the suttas, that word is not found as a reference to the Buddha's teachings, but the word Theravada is only used in this particular sense, where it refers presumably to the Brahmanical tradition. So there you go, if you think you're Theravadan. Now, this passage is, I think, quite decisive in deciding who these people were, because the only scripture that is referred to in the suttas is the Brahmanical scriptures. Right? Now, we know that the Jains and other groups did have scriptures, or at least they evolved scriptures at a certain point of time, but we don't actually hear any references to those within the Pali Canon. So it seems likely that they weren't perhaps formalized or weren't so well known or so prominent at the time. The only spiritual scriptures that's actually mentioned at all in the Buddhist text is the three Vedas and the ancillary literature. So when the Buddha's referring here to memorizing the scriptures, then as far as I'm concerned, that's decisive that he must have been practicing in a Brahmanical tradition, remembering that by this time the Brahmanical tradition was quite diverse. Okay. Then it occurred to me, it is not solely by mere faith that Alara Kalama declares, "I have realized this teaching with my own insight and live having achieved it." Surely he meditates knowing and seeing this teaching. Okay, so again, this is another interesting dimension of this teaching, which is one of the things that the Buddha brought into his teaching, right? Not by mere faith, and the Pali here is sadha mataka, which literally means mere faith. And so it's interesting that in the Indian tradition before the Buddha, this idea it's not dismissing faith, but it's certainly not exalting faith as one of the highest virtues. Right? Faith itself is fine, but there's something more to it than just faith. And so the idea that you can sayang abhinya sachikatwa upasampadja viharati, I mean, these are exactly the same phrases that the Buddha was later to use to realizing his own teaching. Oh, that's right. I was going to say that idea that the tradition should not be faith alone is in fact something which is found in the Upanishadic tradition. If we look into the oldest Brahmanical scriptures, the Vedas, we find what is essentially a liturgical literature. The Vedas are largely songs and hymns in celebration of the feats and the exploits of the gods, in homage to the gods and celebration of nature and these kinds of things. We don't find very much philosophical content to them. However, we do find some philosophical content, and even then, even in the Vedas themselves, one of the most important philosophical texts deals with the concept of creation, and the whole thing is very interesting, but what's most interesting about it is it reaches the end, and then it says, who was it that made all of this? And then it says, only he who sits in the highest heaven and surveys all this creation from above, only he knows. Or perhaps even he doesn't know. Right? So right within that oldest tradition that we have, there's this idea of this kind of slightly skeptical, slightly inquiring, this kind of sense of wonder about the possibility of knowing. And it's a very different attitude than we find within the Western tradition and the biblical tradition. So in the Upanishads, one of the great themes of the Upanishads. So the Upanishads came several hundred years after the Vedas, but the oldest Upanishads are maybe 200 or 300 years before the Buddha. And in those Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, particularly, one of the overriding themes is Ya Evang Veda, one who knows this. Ya Evang Veda, and the text is constantly saying this. Ya Evang Veda, and so when it's talking about the hymns or the rituals or beliefs or the ideas, then it's not about the external forms of these things. It's about knowing what the hidden secret meaning of them is. And this is what it means, is when you're doing these rituals, you don't just do them mindlessly, but you understand what the secret significance of them is. This is what that means, Ya Evang Veda, one who knows this. And so it's constantly pointing back to this idea of the personal experience and understanding and embodying these teachings through knowledge. So this is, you know, very much a precursor of the Buddhist idea of understanding through insight. So I approached Salara Kalama and said to him, Reverend Kalama, to what extent do you say you've realized this teaching with your own insight? When I said this, he declared the dimension of nothingness, the Akinchanya Yatana. And this, of course, is one of the four formless attainments, which lie beyond the four jhanas. So this is a very high state of samadhi in the regular scheme of the eight states of samadhi. This is the seventh. No, hang on. It's the seventh? Yes, yes. This is number seven out of eight. So it's pretty good. Then it occurred to me, it's not just Alara Kalama who has, and he goes on to list five qualities. Not only Alara Kalama who has faith, energy, mindfulness, immersion or samadhi, and wisdom. I too have those things. Why don't I make an effort to realize the same teaching that Alara Kalama says he has realized with his own insight? I quickly realized that teaching with my own insight and lived having achieved it. So these are the qualities which the Bodhisattva has developed up to that point: faith, energy, mindfulness, immersion or samadhi, and wisdom. And of course, these are very familiar in Buddhist teachings as being what we call the five whats. Who can tell me? So Indriya. Five Indriya, thank you, which I mentioned a couple of days ago, right? The Indriyas and the five, also the five, sorry, you're laughing? No? But yeah, five, also five Balas. Sorry, Jessica's laughing, I just thought there's something, was there a joke we missed? No. It's all right, that's fine, I just thought I'd missed out on a joke, that's all right. So yes, the five Indriyas are the five Balas. So in other words, these are five qualities which the Buddha took and made central to his path. Now, when the Buddha's taking these things, it's not necessarily, you know, applying it in exactly the same way that it meant there, right? I mean, these are general terms, and the exact interpretation of them was probably somewhat different, especially the factor of wisdom. But it's still very striking that these are, essentially, the Buddha's acknowledging that he lifted these directly from the teachings of his former teachers. And we find these kinds of things constantly throughout the suttas. Anyway, so he realizes this thing and goes and asks Reverend Kalama, Alara Kalama, Reverend Kalama, did you realize this up to this point? And the Bodhisattva says, I too have realized this teaching with my own insight. We are fortunate, Reverend, so very fortunate to see a venerable such as yourself as one of our spiritual companions. So the teaching that I've realized with my own insight and live having achieved it, you've realized with your own insight and live having achieved it. The teaching that you've realized with your own insight and live having achieved it, I've realized with my own insight and declare having achieved it. And the teaching I know, you know, and the teaching that you know, I know. I am like you and you are like me. Come now, Reverend, we should both lead this community together. And that is how my teacher, Alara Kalama, placed me, his student, on the same position as him and honored me with lofty praise. So this is, again, a very fascinating and very interesting detail, right? I mean, for a start, it shows how much integrity that Alara Kalama had, right? I mean, not many people would do that, yeah? To actually have that humility to say, well, this person's reached the same level as I do. Let's go and do this together. It also suggests, kind of interestingly enough, that this was kind of rare, right? I mean, there was presumably a community there. We don't know how many people were there, but you know, these presumably were quite well-known teachers, and we guess that they probably had a number of students. Obviously, this was regarded as somewhat exceptional that the Bodhisattva was achieving this. I mean, again, whether you want to take that as, you know, 100% literally historical or not is a bit beside the point. The main point here is that this was regarded as a very exalted and very rare attainment, that even those people who were very dedicated spiritual practitioners who had gone forth to achieve it, even among those people, that this was considered to be something that's quite special. And so this is kind of the point of this narrative, right? The point of this narrative is to say that the Buddha went and practiced with the very best, and he achieved the very highest level, right? It's a bit like saying, you know, if you're a programmer and you're like, well, I went and, you know, studied at MIT and went and worked at Google and, you know, and this is your kind of qualifications. This is the qualification. You've been with the very best. And then despite that, the Bodhisattva went on and said, then it occurred to me, this teaching doesn't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening and extinguishment. It only leads as far as rebirth in the dimension of nothingness. Realizing that this teaching was inadequate, I left disappointed. So, again, I mean, most of us would probably feel pretty good about ourselves, right? I mean, you go there and you're like, you realize this really super duper wowzer meditation. And you go to your teacher and say, hey, I've got this really cool stuff. And they say, yeah, it really is cool stuff. You know, let's be famous meditation teachers together. That's what we all want, right? And he says, nah, it's not good enough. So notice the reason why it's not good enough is because it's still connected with rebirth. It's still connected with rebirth. So the idea in Buddhism, that one of the basic teachings is that the place that we get reborn and the state that we get reborn is related to the intentions and so on that we develop in this life. And normally the intentions that we have in our life and the choices that we make, of course there's many of them, right? We make many different choices and all of them can affect the course that our mind goes after we die. However, if we reach a very powerful state of meditation, especially a jhana state of meditation, or a formless state like this, then this is such a powerful state of mind that it overpowers any of the other karma. Right, and the Buddha compares it to the sound of a very loud trumpeter who makes such a loud noise that it overpowers any other kind of noise, and you can hear it in any of the directions. I used to live with a trumpeter in Sydney, so I can confirm that that's the case. The trumpet players used to practice in the cliffs overlooking the ocean in Sydney. So if you walked around in the kind of morning time around the cliffs, you could hear these sort of jazz trumpets coming from various points around the cliffs. Anyway, so so the idea is that if you get into a state of jhana or a state of samadhi, especially if you develop it well, that it creates such an overpowering force in the mind that leads you to be reborn in a state of rebirth which corresponds with that state of meditation. Okay, so that so you basically get into a state of meditation for that period of time, usually maybe a few hours or something like that, and then when you die, you get reborn and you stay in that state of rebirth, which is a state corresponding to that meditation state, and you stay there for a very long time. And according to the suttas, the rebirth in the realm of nothingness lasts for how long? Anyone know? How long do you get to be reborn in the realm of nothingness? No, you do get out of it. Yeah. It's only temporary. How many years? 1 million years. We have 1 million years. Any advance on 1 million years? Do I hear 2 million years? Do you hear 2 million years? Does anybody know how long it is? How long does the universe last? I think it's about, it's like 15 billion years or something like that. Is that right? 30.8 billion years. I think you're right. I think that's like a revised date, isn't it? I think more recently they've increased it about 30 billion, right? Right, yeah. We actually had a discussion about that at Bodhinyana a few years ago. One of Ajahn Brahm's friends from Cambridge at the physics department there, I can't remember his name, but they were students, he was a student with Stephen Hawking in Cambridge, and he's been sort of teaching there ever since. I can't remember his name now. Anyway, he came to Bodhin Yana and we had a discussion and we talked about all of these kinds of things, and that date came up, because I think the formally the date was less, and then Brahmali said that he worked it out from the right. He worked it out from the suttas that the length of time of one eon should be roughly 30 billion years. And then the physicist said, oh yeah, actually that's the new date in physics that they've now revised it to. So the physics is just coming. Well, I make no claims about that. Maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't know. But anyway, about 30 billion years is one eon. Now, if we assume that one universal cycle is equivalent to one eon in Buddhism, right? Let's assume that, whether it is or not, I don't know, that then the rebirth in the realm of the first jhana is one eon. Okay, so that's one whole universe long, is you get to stay in the first jhana. In the second jhana, it's two eons. Anyway, it goes up, and by the time we get to this one, the realm of nothingness, it's 60,000 eons. All right. So what that is that's a reflection of the power and the stability of these attainments. Right? And so again, when it comes to these things, you know, how literally are we supposed to take it? What exactly does that mean? How does that map on to the physical age of the universe? Look, these are 2,500-year-old spiritual texts. I think we have to be cautious about how we interpret them. But the message of that, the point of that, is that this is a pretty damn good stuff. Okay, that's basically the idea. But that's it, right? So basically the Buddha's like, well, I could go and like bliss out in this incredibly peaceful thing, which is just sort of like unbelievably more peaceful and blissful than you could ever possibly imagine, and stay there for 60,000 years, but that's rubbish. Sorry, 60,000 universe cycles, but that's rubbish, right? That's nothing. That's not good enough for me. So this is what he's giving up. Anyway, so he then left there and went on to practice with Uddaka Ramaputta. And basically, I won't repeat the whole story, but basically went through the same story, except Rama, there's a couple of details which are different. First of all is that Rama taught the next level of meditation, which is the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, which is the eighth of the attainments. And the second thing, which is an interesting little detail, is that the text implies that Uddaka Ramaputta did not himself realize that attainment, whereas Alara Kalama did. In fact, the sutta says that Rama had realized that attainment, not Ramaputta, the son of Rama. So whether Ramaputta is the spiritual son of Rama, as in his heir, or whether his actual son is unclear, but it seems as if Rama had attained these, but Uddaka Ramaputta had not. Hence, when it comes to the end, whereas Alara Kalama said that they should lead the community together, Rama, in fact, said that the Bodhisattva should lead the community himself. And so he placed the Bodhisattva on a higher position than himself. So that particular difference, and it's been pointed out in it's of text critical significance, because the grammatical difference between one of those passages and the next is very slight, but they vary in the tenses, right? So that teaching which Rama knew, so you know, and the tenses are very slightly different, and yet that very slight difference is actually maintained consistently across all the different versions of the text. And so it's a testament to how precisely that small difference was maintained. So then the Bodhisattva also left that teaching feeling disappointed. So this is the end of that particular passage. Now, to return to Klaus's question from, was it 3 nights ago now? I told you I wouldn't forget, right? So Klaus asked a question which is a sort of quite a common problem of interpretation in this passage, is that, well, what's going on? Because later on the Buddha said that he got into first jhana, and then he said this is the path to enlightenment, but here he's getting into like even deeper states of meditation and he's saying this isn't good enough. So what's the difference, right? I mean, he must have been through all the jhanas. I mean, it says that he'd attained samadhi, which means that the four jhanas, so he's obviously practicing jhanas and even deeper states than jhanas, and yet he doesn't make that link. So what is the difference? Well, the difference is that when he was a kid, as we talked about when we discussed that his experience when he was a kid, there wasn't any doctrine involved. There wasn't any view. It was just a process of nature. This is there's a distinctively different tone and style to the circumstances, right? When he and notice how that this passage emphasizes again and again and again that you're practicing Sakang Acharya Kang, right? You're practicing your own teacher's lineage. You're practicing the Theravada, right? The doctrine of the elders, yeah? That you are memorizing and lip reciting the texts. The entire framing of that passage is to say that this is an experience which is in order to implement those things which you have learnt in those texts. And of course, like I said, it doesn't actually specify what those texts are in the passage. However, we can say, I think, with a fairly good degree of confidence that it would have been the Vedas and quite probably the Upanishadic teachings, whether they learnt the Upanishads as such or certainly Upanishadic ideas, which are referred to frequently in the suttas. So the essence of those Upanishadic ideas is something like that when you reach these deep states of meditation, you realize that the boundaries around your little self, your little Atman, which you think is your personal self, dissolve. And you realize that your personal self in reality is identical with the divinity that is the cosmos. Right? This is the Upanishadic teaching, yeah? Tad tvang asi, yeah? Thou art that. And so the idea that, or as the suttas would often put it, so atta so loko, the self is identical with the cosmos. So this idea that you dissolve yourself and that you immerse with that experience of the oneness, which is the universe, then the Buddha in his experience, and when he's practicing it, he realizes, oh, well, actually, this is just a state of being. Right? It's just a state of being reborn. I'm just going to get reborn. I'll be in this state and I'll be like that for a while, you know, a good long while, and then it comes to an end. And so he began to realize that there's some kind of limitation to it. So the fact that meditation attainment didn't happen purely as a natural process, but it happened as an outcome of a particular philosophy and a particular kind of doctrine shaped that experience. And so this is the difference, that when he practices as a child, even though it was even a lesser, weaker form of samadhi, only first jhana, then it was a natural process. So this, to me, the point is that he could recollect that this is actually something which is not bound up with that particular metaphysical set of beliefs. Does that answer your question? Think about it. Get back to me in 3 days. Of course, yeah. So, you read this Buddha as the first jhana. Of course, yeah. Right, yeah.
Because there's no this
I think the experience when you're having the experience is basically the same. I mean, it's never like exactly the same, right? But it's basically the same. But it's about the way that you see the experience or the way you interpret it. Like I think when he was a kid, I don't think that he interpreted it at all, right? I mean, it's just an experience. When you're a kid, you just have that experience, like, wow, you know? Then there's a theory, and that theory gives a particular reading to it.
Yeah. Can you get enlightened without meditating?
Can you get enlightened without meditating? Well, try it and get back to me. There's hope for us yet, right? Well, I mean, is it possible to win an Olympic marathon without training? Possible, maybe. Okay, so you have a question?
Yeah. What was supposed to be happening when this lifetime in these former states expired?
When what was expired?
When
when it's expired, what happens? Oh, you come back here.
In the human realm.
What's happening in the human realm while all that's happening?
No, you get into the
homeless
realm, and you get either.
Right. Yeah, human realm or one of the other realms, yeah. Most of the time, yeah. Sometimes you can get enlightened right away from there. But sorry? We'll still be here. Will humans... Well, I don't know if... I mean... Something will still be here. All right? I mean, humans come and go. We're very sentient beings. I mean, the earth won't be here. That'll be kind of burnt up to a crisp. Yeah. So, but yeah, sentient beings will re-evolve. Yeah. For better or for worse.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Which part is what is not the main unnatural?
It's not that it's unnatural. It's shaped by a metaphysic. So it's seen within the concept of a metaphysic. Look, it's very that's how things go. If I'm a Christian and I sit down and meditate, then I see a light in my meditation. Then I'll come out of my meditation. I'll say I saw God. That's just naturally how you see it. So if you study the Upanishads and you go into your meditation and you have that kind of experience and you say, oh, this is, I became Brahman. You know, this is just natural that that's the way you would interpret it. Yeah, so it's not that there's anything wrong with the experience as such. It's just that that's your beliefs and ideas about it will shape the way that you see it. As Buddhists, then that will still apply to us as Buddhists, but we're conditioned to see that experience as impermanent. Right? So our views still shape how we interpret the experience. That bit is the same, right? The difference is that our views about that experience are not metaphysical, right? So if I see that this state will lead to a rebirth that's eternal and will last forever and is the divinity of the cosmos, then this is a metaphysical interpretation of it. But if our reading of it is, well, this is a condition which has been created by certain practices and which is characterized by certain mental qualities and which will last for a while and which will come to an end, that's a view about it. Yeah, it's a theory, but it's a theory based on the empirical reality of the experience itself. So it's closer to the experience.
The natural is not
Right. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
The natural way of a child.
All right, yeah.
Is it more than to overcome the faculties?
Well, I mean, the child isn't thinking about those things at all, right? The child is just sitting there being peaceful. Yeah. Philip, go on. No? You're good? Okay. Michael. The string mantra, yeah.
Yeah. And then when they are reborn in these states, then, I mean, they very high achieved, so they will be reborn in states where they stay for, say, 60,000 eons.
Maybe. But a string mantra doesn't necessarily practice the formless attainments. Yeah.
I was wondering what would happen if, say, an enlightened being, if the good karma of an enlightened being expires at a time where, I mean, all of this depends on the belief that, I mean, if you are reborn in the next universe, then that there are still human beings.
Oh, right, yeah.
That you can be reborn.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. See, that's why karma isn't deterministic, right? So karma is just sort of creating a set of karma is just creating a certain set of conditions, but if the external conditions are not appropriate, then it won't ripen. And so it's the same as like if you have a seed from a mango tree, the seed from a mango tree will sprout with a mango tree, right? It can't sprout. You can't grow a carrot from a mango tree, right? That's the nature of that seed, but it's only going to become, it's only going to sprout when there is soil and when there's moisture and when the weather is okay.
So you're saying that you're then stuck in heaven realm as long as...
Or you get reborn somewhere else, right? Because we've got a whole bunch of karma from the past that can send us wherever we like, right? Yeah? So the tendency is that you, if... this theory is sort of worked out in detail in the Abhidhamma, but the basic idea is that if you have a strong karma or a habitual karma or a karma which is some kind of overwhelming karma or something like that, then that will determine when you get reborn. But if you lack any of those kinds of things, then you'll fall back on some kind of karma that you've made in the past. Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, if you think of the karma that conditions rebirth as arising from our moral choices, then you think about how many moral choices that you make in this life, right? Each act of giving is an act of karma, and that can determine your rebirth, right? Each act of being a bastard also is determining your karma. Each trollish comment that you've left on Twitter, yeah? Right? And so, yeah, just, you know, be careful about that. Okay, so look, we've been going on for a little while. We should wrap up now. So what I'd like to propose is that for tomorrow we do something a little bit different, and I'd like to have a youth group for tomorrow. So this would be a discussion. And normally, at the same time, we would do the interviews, and only for the young people. So that's only under 40s. So old people, bad luck. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, boomer. Yeah. And for the old people, then they get to be happy by being in here and meditating. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. So for the under 40s, then if you would like to come and have a discussion, then we'll do that tomorrow. We'll do it in the room where I'm doing the interviews from, I think it's 3 o'clock we start. So we'll do it there. And the interviews we'll put off to the day after. Okay, so if you've put your name down for interviews already, then my apologies, but we'll do that the following day. All right? Okay? If you don't want to come, if you'd rather just meditate, that's fine. But for those who'd like to come for a discussion, then please do. What is it about? I can't say while the old people are here.